Good afternoon, colleagues. We're going to begin this afternoon's business with First Minister's questions. But before we turn to questions, the First Minister will give the Chamber a brief statement on the COVID figures. First Minister.
Thanks, Presiding Officer. I will give a short update on the daily COVID statistics and related matters. The total number of positive cases reported yesterday was 290. This represents 4% of people newly tested, and the total number of cases is therefore now 23,573. The full regional breakdown will be published as usual later, but I can confirm that 112 of those cases were in Greater Glasgow and Clyde, 52 in Lanarkshire and 47 in Lothian. The remaining 79 are across 9 other health board areas. 52 people are in hospital, which is an increase of 1 from yesterday. And I would remind members that we changed the definition of what is a COVID hospital inpatient earlier this week to make it more accurate. And 5 people are in intensive care, which is 1 fewer than the number yesterday. In the past 24 hours, no deaths were registered of patients tested positive for COVID, and the total number of deaths under this measurement remains 2,501. And yet again, my condolences, and I'm sure those of everybody across the chamber, go to everyone who has lost a loved one. I can also report that the Scottish Government will shortly publish our latest estimate of the R number, which is the number of people who will, on average, be infected by one infectious person. This confirms our view that the R number is currently above 1 in Scotland, possibly as high as 1.4. Of course, we hope that the new rules, which came into effect on Monday, will help reduce transmission, and we will, of course, monitor this very carefully. We are also considering carefully, obviously on an ongoing basis, whether any further restrictions may be necessary either for all or part of the country. Secondly, I would remind people that the case figures we report daily are for test results reported in the past 24 hours. Now, ideally, these daily figures will by and large reflect test swabs taken within the preceding 48 hours. Right now, though, more of these daily cases are from swabs taken over the preceding few days. This is due to the backlog in the UK-wide laboratory network that I've spoken about this week. Now, to be clear, this doesn't affect our trend analysis of the virus, because that looks at cases by date of sample, not just reporting date. However, delays in test results being reported can delay contact tracing for some cases, which is why we're taking this so seriously. I can report to the Chamber that there has been an improvement in the past couple of days, which is positive. However, there are still some outstanding results from the past week, and so we continue to follow this up rigorously. We're also in regular and constructive contact with the UK Government, and of course we are committed to working with them to help address this issue. And finally, can I note that in the week since it was launched, more than 1 million people have now downloaded the Protect Scotland app, and I want to thank everyone who has done so. 1 million is already a big enough number for us to know that the app can make a difference. In fact, I can report that more than 100 people have already been advised to isolate as a result of using it. So I would encourage everyone who hasn't yet done so to download it. This is a simple, and it is simple, but it's also an important way in which we can all help fight COVID. Of course, the other way of all of us doing that is by sticking to the rules and guidance. So I'll end, Presiding Officer, simply by summarising these again. If you live in Glasgow, East or West Dumbartonshire, Renfrewshire or East Renfrewshire, or North or South Lanarkshire, please do not visit other households at all right now anywhere in Scotland. In the rest of the country, please don't meet with more than 6 people from a maximum of 2 households. These limits on gatherings apply indoors and outdoors, and indoors they apply in pubs and restaurants as well as in houses. And finally, let's all remember facts. Face coverings, avoid crowded places, clean hands and hard surfaces, keep 2 metres away from people in other households, and self-isolate and book a test if you experience any of the symptoms of COVID. My thanks to everyone for the continued efforts across the country to help us beat the virus back.
Thank you very much, First Minister. I would remind members that under the current circumstances, we'll take all supplementary questions at the end of the 7th question, after the 7th question. However, if you wish to ask a supplementary at any point, please just press your button now or as soon as possible. Question number one, Ruth Davidson.
Thank you, Presiding Officer. 2 years ago this week, I raised with the First Minister the case of Michelle Stewart, who was stabbed to death, aged 17, by John Wilson in 2008. Michelle's family have been campaigning ever since to strengthen the rights of victims, And 2 years ago, they were promised concrete action by the First Minister and her government. We spoke again this morning to Michelle's family, and this is what they told us. Hamza Yousaf seems to think he's done a lot. There's certainly been a lot of talking, but there's been very little action. It's now been 2 years since we met him about this and when he promised to take action, and it's time he delivered on that. I know that the Justice Secretary is now meeting again with Michelle's family next week. 2 years on, will he finally be getting the action they need?
First Minister.
A number of different steps have been taken, and I'm aware that Ruth Davison and members across the Chamber know what they are. Of course, Parliament has been involved in some of those. Of course, we want to continue to listen to the victims of crime and reflect on other steps that can be taken. We must always seek to make sure not just that the voice of victims of crime is heard, but their experiences help to inform further reforms in the justice system. Of course, in any justice system, the rights of the accused are important. Everybody recognises that, but we must make sure that we have a system that reflects the needs and experiences of those who are the victims of crime, and where changes are required, the government has not and will not shy away from making those. I'm very happy to circulate, not just to Ruth Davison, but to the Chamber later on today, just to remind people a summary of the changes that have been made. And of course, if there are further actions that the government intends to take after further discussions, we will update the Parliament accordingly.
Ruth Davison.
Thank you. The fact is that the action that was promised 2 years ago and the reality, despite what the First Minister claims, is pretty different, and little has been done to address the concerns of Michelle's family or the victims of so many crimes. But we can look at some of the issues that have been introduced. If we take, for example, the victim notification scheme, which is intended to give victims information on those who offended against them. And that's important information, such as if the offender is eligible for temporary release, if they abscond from prison, if they return to prison for any reason connected to the victim's case, and crucially, when they're due back out on the street after release. Well, this week we discovered that fewer than one in four Scottish victims of crime are signed up to that notification scheme, and Victim Support Scotland says it's down to the current system being overly complicated to both understand and administer. So will the First Minister give a commitment today to overhaul that notification scheme so that Scottish victims of crime can finally get the information that they deserve?
First Minister.
I will, of course, with the Justice Secretary, consider whether there are further changes required to that. We want to make any scheme like this as accessible to people who can benefit from using it as possible. And, of course, we want to make any bureaucracy around that as simple as possible and, in fact, remove it as much as we can. I think it is important to stress, though, that all victims of crime who are eligible for the victim notification scheme are able to make an informed decision about whether or not they wish to sign up to that. The fact of the matter is, while many do, and we have to make sure that the system works for them, I absolutely recognise that, the fact is not all victims want to be informed of a prisoner's release, because for some victims they find that that is re-traumatising for them. So it is really important, and it is right, that victims have the ability to decide voluntarily whether or not to opt into this scheme before they receive any information. And through the Victims Task Force and, of course, regular meetings with victims' organisations, we are striving to provide services to victims that are trauma-informed, and that includes the Victim Notification Scheme. And, of course, we will continue to work with organisations representing victims and, indeed, others to consider whether further improvements to that scheme can and should be made.
Ruth Davison.
Well, the organisations that do represent victims have been pretty clear. Kate Wallace, the Chief Executive of Victim Support Scotland, says the current system is complicated to understand and administer. Often people are asked about joining it at an unsuitable time when they are most traumatised, and this is often not revisited. But let's look at another area where victims were promised action, but where it's failed up to live to expectations, and that's the Victim Surcharge Fund. The surcharge was introduced as an extra financial penalty on all criminals who are sentenced to pay a court fine. The money raised is supposed to go to a separate fund intended to help support victims. But a third of the money supposed to be paid in simply isn't being collected. So why are so many criminals being allowed to skip paying their dues while the victims continue to suffer?
First Minister.
Well, in terms of the victim surcharge, that was introduced in November 2019. Anyone committing a crime that results in a court fine is now charged an additional penalty, the victim surcharge. The money is banked in the victim surcharge fund and it will be used to provide direct support to victims and families. And I can tell the Chamber that the aim is to open the victim surcharge fund for bids from victims' organisations by the end of this year. The impact on court business, of course, of COVID has in some ways delayed and may continue to delay this, but that intention and aim is still there. We continue to work across all of these issues sensitively and appropriately with victims' organisations, and that of course includes Victim Support Scotland. The Victim Support Scotland support for families bereaved by crime service launched in April 2018, for example, and we've consulted on expanding the range of serious crimes where, for example, victims can make statements to the court. So across a whole range of these issues, action has been taken, changes have been made, but of course, as any government I think should do, we will continue to listen to where further action can be taken and needs to be taken, and the voice of victims of crime will very much be at the heart of that.
Ruth Davidson.
I don't doubt the First Minister's intentions, but good intentions aren't enough. The record of her government simply doesn't match up to the rhetoric when it comes to the strengthening of the rights of victims of crime. The family of Michelle Stewart, as with so many other victims, feel desperately let down by this government. And families consistently say that they want three things: to be heard during the process, to receive information about the offender, and practical support. And as we've heard today from the experiences of Michelle's family and so many others, this government is falling short in all three of these areas. So 2 years ago, the First Minister promised concrete action that would tip the scales back in victims' favour. When are we finally going to see it?
First Minister.
I think, to be frank, I've already gone through a range of issues today where change has happened, and it is to the great credit of victims of crime who make the case for those changes when, of course, the trauma of crime itself is very significant, and we will continue to listen to that. It is always going to be the case, and I say this frankly and openly, that for victims of crime, and I think if I was the victim of a serious crime, I would feel exactly the same. You will always want more to be done, and I think it is important to listen to that. But any government has an often very difficult balance to strike between the rights of victims and the voice of victims, but also the essential rights within a criminal justice system of an accused person to ensure a fair trial and a fair process of justice. These are often not easy issues, but ones that we take extremely seriously. So whether it is about the victim notification scheme, the victim surcharge, the work that we have done with victims' organisations to ensure that the voice of victims is heard, that victims feel that they have the information should they want it. And I go back to a point I made earlier, not all victims of crime will want all of this information, but where they do, they have that. And of course, while this is no comfort to anyone who has experienced serious crime, and I wouldn't want anybody to think that I was making this point in order to suggest that it was, but of course we do see, because of a range of things that the government has done, not least to support police numbers across the country, we do see crime levels generally, although they will fluctuate obviously from time to time, but generally levels of crime lower now than they were some time ago. So we continue to take these issues seriously. We will continue to listen to victims, as it has already been alluded to today. The Justice Secretary will meet with Michelle Stewart's family to listen to further views there, and we will continue to act in a way that tries to strike that difficult but important balance that I have already spoken about.
Thank you very much. Question number two, Richard Leonard.
Presiding Officer, First Minister, I've been asked by workers in residential children's units in Glasgow to raise with you their real concerns. They've been told to self-isolate at home because they have had close contact with a young resident who has tested positive for COVID-19. But they are also being instructed to continue to go to work. These staff have been sent letters saying that although they and their own family households must self-isolate for 14 days, their place of work is being considered, and I quote, as a second household setting by Greater Glasgow and Clyde Health Board, and that they are part of the, I quote again, children's unit bubble. This is not safe, and in fact, it is a direct contravention of the guidance set out by Health Protection Scotland. These frontline workers are anxious. They are concerned that they may spread the virus to the people they care for at home and at work. So, First Minister, what can you do to ensure that these residential childcare units in Glasgow allow staff to properly self-isolate when necessary and stick to the guidance of Health Protection Scotland?
First Minister.
I will personally look into this as soon as I get out of the chamber. I'm not familiar with the terms of the letter. I'm very clear about the guidance, and of course the guidance in Greater Glasgow and Clyde, with the exception of Inverclyde, right now is more strict in terms of isolation of household contacts than it is elsewhere in the country. Of course, residential services, there will be some circumstances where a different situation applies because of the nature of those services, but I wouldn't want to, without having seen the letter that Richard Leonard refers to myself, to say now whether I think that is appropriate or not appropriate. What is absolutely clear to me is that all necessary precautions must be taken to limit the spread of the virus. And, of course, workers, and that absolutely includes workers in residential children's services, must feel safe and supported in their workplace. So if Richard Leonard wants to pass the contacts of the people who have contacted him or get them to contact me directly, I'll make sure that I personally look into this as a matter of urgency this afternoon.
Richard Leonard.
Thank you, and thanks for that answer. And I certainly will pass that information over, because there is a real concern that the trade union involved has not been involved in drawing up any of this guidance, that the staff do not have access to appropriate PPE at all times, and that they do not have regular and routine access to testing. And let me turn to testing. Since the start of the pandemic, the Scottish Government's testing programme has been hampered with delays and difficulties. Last month, it was limited access. This week, it is a growing backlog and a slow turnaround of results. The Scottish Government's latest testing strategy is supposed to be about getting Scotland prepared for winter. We all understand that it relies on the UK testing infrastructure, and the First Minister has said in the last few days that she and her Health Secretary have spoken repeatedly to the UK's Health Secretary, Matt Hancock. So can she tell us what guarantees she has secured that tests in Scotland will not be rationed or restricted, that her commitments on testing targets will be met, and that the Scotland's first approach, as outlined in her testing strategy, will be delivered?
First Minister.
These are important issues. Can I say, first of all, I think our test and protect system is working extremely well, and I think that's a great credit to the experts and contact tracers across the country. If we consider the protect part of that in particular, and figures on this are published weekly, well over 90% of all index cases, so people who test positive and their contacts, have been traced, which is a very good record and one we want to maintain. Clearly, for that to work as effectively as possible, the testing part has to operate quickly as well. And by and large, it has been. We have, over the past few days, been experiencing longer turnaround times through the laboratory UK-wide Lighthouse lab network than we would want to see. I've spoken personally to Matt Hancock and Dido Harding, who heads up the UK testing system. The Health Secretary spoke to Matt Hancock last night. We have received assurances that the access to testing, which has not been an issue in Scotland in the last few days, the way it has been in England. So people booking a test have not been unable to do that. This is a laboratory processing issue in Scotland, but we have received assurances that Scotland's access to testing through mobile testing units or regional testing centres would not be constrained to try to deal with any of this. And secondly, that Scotland's fair share of the laboratory processing capacity will also be secured. We monitor this carefully. Personally monitor this several times a day. We have seen over the last couple of days an improvement, a reduction in the backlog, and now, of course, we want to make sure that going forward those turnaround times improve as well. This is a UK-wide networked system, and you know, we therefore need to work with the UK government to resolve these constraints. Of course, we have a second strand of testing capacity, which is through the National Health Service. So most of the routine NHS testing is done through the NHS. We're considering whether, as part of what we can do to help solve the UK-wide issues, we move the routine regular care home testing into the NHS as well. So we are working hard to try to resolve these issues. I think we have seen signs of improvement, but I think overall it's important to say that our system is working well, and what we are focused on doing is making sure it is resilient and capable of continuing to work well as we go into what is going to be a difficult winter period. And I think it's important for all of us to continue to stress to people that if they have symptoms of COVID, they should be accessing a test and self-isolating as well.
Richard Leonard.
Thank you. And I wonder if the First Minister, as part of her considerations, could think of this. Because at the weekend, a survey of home care workers and Unison members revealed that half of them had never been tested for COVID-19. Mike Kirby, the Scottish Secretary of Unison, said at the weekend of the survey, routine screening is how care staff protect their vulnerable clients and keep infection rates low. This is an urgent issue that needs dealt with now, or we risk a new wave of coronavirus deaths with this potentially being the cause. So these workers have also asked me to raise their concerns. First Minister, community transmission is increasing. Winter is coming with all the additional pressures that brings. Our dedicated frontline home care staff are rightly anxious. They need all the support and reassurance that we can offer. So will you allay their fears, the fears of these home care workers? Will you reduce their exposure and the exposure of the vulnerable people that they care for? And will you agree to regular and routine access to testing for Scotland's heroic home care workers?
First Minister.
Well, can I say first of all, in terms of workers, and Richard Leonard is right to raise their concerns here, you know, the Health Secretary regularly talks to the trade unions in the health and social care sectors. We are very vigilant about making sure that concerns that those working on the front line have are raised, listened to and addressed. In terms of who we routinely test, we are, as I hope everybody would accept, rightly guided by clinical advice and on that, and will continue to be so. One of the things that we are very clear about is that our response to constraints and capacity at the moment should not be to try to pull back on access to testing of people we think should be tested. Instead, we should tackle the capacity constraints issue. So we want to continue to look at how we expand the people that are, if clinical expertise says that it is appropriate, are tested, and home care workers are certainly one of those groups. You know, every week just now more than 30,000 care home staff are routinely tested, and that's an important part of the protection for care homes. These things are under ongoing and regular review, and it is important that we do take clinical expert advice, but it's also important that we apply our judgment to that, and that's what we'll continue to do.
Thank you very much. Question number three, Alison Johnson.
Thank you. Test and protect is the foundation of Scotland's strategy to contain COVID, but it doesn't work if people can't get a test. The UK testing programme is collapsing, and the Tory government has warned that it will take weeks to resolve. Like many, I'm deeply concerned that we'll pay for this chaos in the coming weeks. The First Minister said that access is not an issue and that the system is working well, but one constituent tells me that she's been simply unable to get a test for her father, who's in a vulnerable condition and has carers visiting daily. Another tells me that after days of trying, she's feeling exasperated and frustrated. At the same time, symptomatic individuals are being sent hundreds of miles for tests, potentially spreading the virus more widely. So does the First Minister accept that the current UK-wide testing regime isn't fit for purpose, and will she return to this chamber with a new testing strategy to further enable NHS Scotland to meet demand?
First Minister.
We'll continue to make sure we've got a strategy in place that is right. I think it's really important here, firstly, to be very frank where we are experiencing challenges. Some have accused me this week of trying to politicise this. Nothing could be further from the truth. I think it's important to be upfront with people where we have challenges and what we're doing to try to address them, and that's what I've sought to do. Equally, I think it's important that we don't you know, sort of suggest, because I wouldn't agree with some of the language that Alison Johnson has used in Scotland. I'm not standing here saying that nobody will ever find it difficult to get a test where they need it without having to travel or wait a period, but we do not at the moment. When schools went back a few weeks ago, we had a surge in demand for testing, which did, for a few days, lead to some difficulties in people accessing tests. That is not what we are seeing in Scotland right now, although I'm not complacent about that, because demand will be variable depending on the overall prevalence of the virus. But I don't think it is right to say that the system in Scotland is not working. We have a capacity constraint in the UK part of the laboratory system that we are working to address, and we are seeing improvements in that, but we have to see those improvements sustained. We will continue to consider I won't go into all of the detail, but from, you know, things like access to contracts for the testing kits and everything, it makes sense to have the four nations cooperating in that in order to maximise access to testing at scale. But we also have a system of NHS laboratories that we route as much as makes sense through, and we'll continue to look at the balance between those two things. But I don't want anybody watching this in Scotland to get anything other than the impression that if they have symptoms, they should with confidence book a test, because that is really important, and we will continue to work hard to make sure that any issues we are experiencing are resolved. And that will be not just working with the UK government, that is important, but also looking at our own resources to make sure that we are bringing them fully to bear on resolving any issues.
Alison Johnson.
Thank you. I agree it's absolutely essential that we continue to work with the UK government, but in the evident absence of an effective Four Nations approach, it's important that the Scottish Government takes all action to augment and improve the situation, because it's really vital that the public have complete confidence in the system. And public buy-in is key to suppressing the virus. That's why there was shock across the UK earlier this week when it emerged that the Tory government had convened an emergency meeting of senior cabinet ministers to exempt hunting and shooting from coronavirus restrictions. For months now, people across the country have made great personal sacrifices to play their part in reducing the spread of this virus. So does the First Minister believe it's fair that at a time when children can't play with all their friends and when families can't visit loved ones in care homes, that shooting parties are permitted to load up their shotguns and head to the hills?
First Minister.
Well, let me be very clear. I've had no meetings in the past week or 2 weeks or any part of COVID to discuss shooting exemptions. There is no specific exemption under the Scottish regulations for shooting. What there is the ability to allow outdoor and sporting activities to be permitted if they meet criteria laid out in legislation, if they follow all the guidance and adhere with physical distancing requirements. And of course that applies to, you know, things like angling, wildlife clubs and pony trekking, as well as the kind of activities that Alison Johnson would talk about. That is not a specific exemption. We continue to consider very carefully the balance of this, because I acutely recognise that there are always unintended consequences in the kind of regulations that we're having to put in place right now. None of us want to be in this position. So both we consider both the need for the kind of restrictions that are in place, but also what exemptions are and are not appropriate there. And we will continue to look at that and make changes where we think those are necessary.
Thank you. Question number four, Willie Rennie.
Yesterday I met Cathy Russell. Her mother is in a care home. They are not allowed to meet for more than 30 minutes a week, and they are separated by a plastic screen. They have not hugged or held hands for 5 months. Her mother's health is in decline. Cathy says people in care homes need their families. In Toronto, they allow a limited number of family carers in care homes. They have PPE and are tested. Why is the First Minister opposed to that for Cathy and her mother?
First Minister.
Can I ask Willie Rennie genuinely, in just in terms of the tone of this, and these questions are absolutely legitimate, but the tone that suggests that somehow I am willingly or deliberately trying to keep families away from loved ones in care homes, these are really difficult decisions. The Health Secretary, I think tomorrow, will be meeting representatives of families who have absolutely legitimate concerns. We know that visiting people in care homes, and there'll be very few of us who don't have some experience of family or friends who've been in care homes, and we know that visiting is a fundamental part of the health and wellbeing of those who live in our care homes, and I think that is particularly true for people with dementia. So it is hugely difficult for all of us to see and hear the distress of families who are not able to interact with loved ones in a normal way. But these restrictions are ultimately in place to try to help us protect care home residents and save lives. And it's important that we continue to recognise the risks of communal living, the risks of infections getting into care homes as we take these decisions. That said, the guidance on families and relatives entering care homes remains under regular and ongoing review. As I said, the Health Secretary will meet family representatives tomorrow, and we do look at whether there are more protections that we could in place to allow a more normal visiting regime in care homes. So I take all of these issues really seriously. There's probably none that have been more difficult and actually at times more genuinely upsetting than the range of decisions we've had to take around care homes. We all want to allow families to visit normally as quickly as possible and as safely as possible, and we will continue to take these difficult decisions absolutely with the best of intentions, but with the greatest care as well.
Willie Rennie.
The First Minister may not like it. I've discussed this with the Health Secretary and the National Clinical Director, so I do know what the issues are at stake. It's been under consideration for weeks, but to be frank, Cathy can't wait any longer. She needs change now. Cathy's mother comes in contact with multiple carers every day. Yet the most important carer of all, her daughter, is left outside. And this is happening to hundreds of people every day. A fraction of them were out there yesterday. So extend testing, give her PPE, check her temperature, make her self-isolate, do whatever it takes to keep them safe, but let her in. So will the First Minister make this happen?
First Minister.
I think Cathy is one of the family members that the Health Secretary is meeting tomorrow. I think around 40% of care homes across the country do now allow and enable indoor visiting, and obviously we want to see more able to do that. Will I make this happen? I will try to take decisions that strike the balance between allowing families to have normal interaction with their loved ones, which I absolutely understand, but also make sure we are doing everything appropriate to protect people in care homes. These are not easy decisions, and it's my job with the Health Secretary and colleagues across the government to take them. We have to do that, and we have to listen to a range of voices and understand all of the difficulties in that. I don't enjoy taking these decisions at all, but we will try to do them, taking the best advice and taking the best factors and balancing those, and get to a position where both where we can have families able to visit normally in care homes, which is what everybody wants more than anything else, but also to make sure that we're not in a position in a few weeks from now, and I don't mean this in any way critically before Willie Rennie suggests that I do, but in order to avoid a situation where a few weeks from now Willie Rennie is asking me questions about why we've got outbreaks of infection in care homes. And that is the difficult balance that we have to try and strike, and we will continue to try to do that to the very best of our intentions. And that is an assurance I can give, not just people across the chamber, but families across the country.
Thank you. Question number five, Brian Whittle.
Thank you, Presiding Officer. To ask the First Minister what the Government's response is to reports that several of Scotland's leisure trusts which operate sports and other leisure facilities are close to financial collapse.
First Minister.
We're in regular dialogue with leisure trusts and councils to understand the impact of COVID on community sport. And of course, this dialogue informed the decision about reopening indoor sport and leisure facilities. The Finance Secretary has also been engaged in discussion with COSLA to finalise the details of a lost income scheme, and has stipulated that this should cover additional financial support for councils' arm's length organisations, including leisure trusts. The Finance Secretary confirmed that we will be providing councils with further funding of £49 million, which they will be required to pass on in full to support services services, including those delivered through arm's-length organisations, to top up those allocations. And she wrote to the Chancellor on the 4th of July requesting details of the consequentials that we can expect to receive to help fund this scheme, but are still, as of now, awaiting a response to that.
Brian Whittle.
Can I thank the First Minister for that answer? I know that she agrees with me that having access to and participating in these kinds of activities is essential for our well-being more now than ever before. However, Leisure Trust do report that 70% of their annual revenue generated is from paying customers, and the current pandemic is having an increasingly serious implications to their ability to sustain their offer. And have said to me that the Scottish Government and COSLA seem to be looking at each other to solve this issue. So, First Minister, we can't afford to risk losing these vital public services. So can I ask that the Scottish Government get together again with COSLA to work out a sustainable solution? And what further support can the Scottish Government offer this crucial sector?
First Minister.
But it is an important issue, and I think it's good that the member has raised it again. I know he's raised it in the past, but can I go back to what I said in my original answer? The Finance Secretary is in discussion with COSLA to finalise the details of a lost income scheme. The corresponding scheme that the UK Government has specifically excludes arm's-length organisations, and it's important in our view that the scheme that the Finance Secretary agrees with COSLA includes financial support for these arm's-length schemes. So I hope that will be a positive development. We still, as I say, are awaiting a response about the consequential funding around schemes like this, but we are getting on with the discussions with COSLA to finalise the details of this, and I'm sure the Finance Secretary will update Parliament as soon as that has been done.
Thank you. Question number six, Stuart McMillan.
Thank you, Presiding Officer, to ask the First Minister what the Scottish Government's response is to reports that the highest proportion of positive COVID-19 tests is among young adults.
First Minister.
Well, obviously, the virus is spreading again. That's obvious from the figures we've been reporting in recent days. And we know that there has been a larger number of young adults returning positive tests than was the case earlier in the pandemic, although our testing approach is different now to then, so that will to some extent account for that. But more recently, the 18 to 39 year age group has shown the highest number of positive cases. That's not surprising. I made this point last week. Young people are more likely to be exposed to the virus because they are more likely to be back at work and being required to be in higher risk situations. Young people are more likely to live in shared accommodation. So it's really important for all of us to say that the increase in cases amongst the younger age groups is not their fault and it's not something they should be blamed for. That said, it's not something that we can or should be complacent about. Younger people are less likely to become seriously ill or die from COVID, but they can still become gravely ill. And of course, we know that many people who get COVID and never go to hospital suffer long-term health complications. And we saw a 29-year-old from Aberdeen report his experience of that just last week. And of course, we know that if the virus spreads in the younger age groups, it will eventually spread into older age groups who we know are at greater risk of illness and death. And that's when we, unfortunately, would start to see cases of hospital admissions, intensive care admissions, and deaths rise. And if we look at countries, for example, France right now, that is the trend that we're seeing there, which is why it's so important for everybody to stick to the restrictions now so that we can try to stem this.
Joe McMillan.
Thank the First Minister for that reply. And she clearly is concerned, and every MSP should be concerned, about the reports of house parties continuing despite the measured approach taken by the Scottish Government and also Police Scotland. And nobody wants an excessive and heavy-handed approach during this challenging time. However, with the greater numbers of local authorities under stricter lockdown measures and COVID-19 cases increasing daily, does the First Minister now consider it appropriate that tougher fines should be implemented for the hosts of house parties?
First Minister.
I think this is a legitimate issue. It's the same issue Christine Graham raised last week, because I hear her reminding me of that behind me. And these are important issues, and we continue to keep all of this under review. I think it's also important that we don't just think where there are really egregious breaches of the regulations, we don't just think of fixed penalty fines, but also the police are able to take more serious prosecution action as well. I think the vast majority of people are abiding by the restrictions, and I think even where some are not, but that will not be deliberately. It may be through a lack of understanding, and that's why it's so important that we continue to try to explain exactly what we're asking people to do and why. But of course, where people are just flagrantly breaching the rules, that should be treated seriously. House parties right now, I understand that young people want to socialise and see friends. Of course they do. There's nothing more natural than that. But house parties right now are a danger. They're a danger to people's health, and frankly, they're a danger to life. And Police Scotland responded to 405 house parties across the country last weekend. So that both demonstrates that we still have to get this message across to people, but also that police are taking appropriate action. Any breaches of the regulations may be subject to enforcement action, including fixed penalty notices that can double for repeat offences up to £960. Where prosecution is deemed appropriate, the Sheriff Court can impose a fine of up to £5,000, and higher fines can be imposed dependent on the charge libelled. But we will continue to keep the level of fines and the enforcement action under review.
Thank you. Question number 7, Monica Lennon.
Thank you, Presiding Officer. To ask the First Minister what urgent action the Scottish Government is taking to restore and support contact between family carers and older and disabled people living in care homes, which is considered essential to their mental, emotional and physical wellbeing.
First Minister.
Well, obviously, I've already given some answers to this question in response to Willie Rennie, but I know, and I hope nobody doubts this, but I want to just make it clear that I understand how difficult this time is for people who have loved ones in care homes. Restrictions on visiting your loved ones is the most challenging thing that I think any of us can imagine. Visiting is a fundamental part of the health and wellbeing of people who live in care homes. Guidance was published on 25th June, which outlined a staged approach to the return of visiting, and currently limited outdoor and indoor visiting is recommended, provided strict criteria are met. Balancing the risks to care homes from COVID exposure and from reduced social interaction needs to take account of a range of factors, including that many residents we know are more vulnerable to the effects of COVID exposure. And that, of course, becomes an ever more important and challenging consideration when community prevalence is on the rise as it is now. But we hope to open up further visiting options for families as soon as it is safe to do so.
Monica Lennon.
I thank the First Minister for her response, and I am pleased that the Health Secretary will meet with Cathy Russell and engage with the Care Home Relative Scotland group. What I would say to both Willie Rennie and the First Minister is that this is not just about the timetabling of visits. It's about recognising and reinstating family caregivers as equal partners in their loved ones' care. We all want to eliminate the virus, but we also need to address the psychological and physical harms of separating care home residents from their families. Experts and campaigners call it a hidden catastrophe. Sunday Mail editor Lorna Hughes wrote movingly about the guilt she feels about her mother being alone in a care home, and there are thousands more like her. We need to change the story before it's too late. We must end this hidden catastrophe in care homes and avoid a winter of separation. So can I ask the First Minister to agree that family caregivers are important partners, and that the Scottish Government finds a way to urgently change the guidance in order to facilitate their vital role?
First Minister.
Yes is my immediate answer to that. I do recognise, and I think it is an important point, that there is a wider principle at stake here, which is that we're not just talking here about family members visiting loved ones in care homes. It is about the role that family members play in the care of loved ones in care homes. And I think that is both an important point to recognise, but it also may be, and it's why the Health Secretary was keen to meet with family representatives as soon as possible, it may be that that does provide some of the answers and solutions to us as we try to strike the right balance. What I'm saying here is of no comfort to anybody in this position. As I say, we've all, I'm sure there's very few people in Scotland that haven't had at some point experience of a loved one in a care home. We all understand how difficult this is, and so what I'm about to say comes as no comfort to anybody in this position. But in the midst of a whole host of daily decisions that are the most difficult I've ever faced in my life, this is the most difficult. I have perfectly legitimately over the course of the last weeks and months been challenged in the chamber about the numbers of people who died in care homes at an earlier stage of this pandemic. And, you know, absolutely, that will stay with me forever, that whole experience. Now, that doesn't mean that we then take an approach that is overly cautious and keeps people away from their loved ones. Absolutely, that would be equally a wrong thing to do. But it does mean we take these decisions so seriously about trying to get this as right as possible. And I would ask people, whether you agree or disagree with the conclusions we are reaching here, is please don't doubt the care and the seriousness and the real weight of responsibility that we all feel in reaching these decisions. And we will try with families and with those who speak up for their loved ones rightly. So we will try to get that as right as possible and to get back to a position as quickly as possible that people want to be in. And also, as we have to do in so many aspects of this pandemic, use it as a way to ask some of these more fundamental questions, which is one of which is what is the role in care of family members for people in care homes. So, you know, none of that helps a person who's not seeing their loved one in a care home. I know that, but I hope it does give some indication of the fact that these are not straightforward decisions and they are ones that we do take very, very seriously.
Thank you. Can I move to supplementary questions? Alistair Allan, to be followed by Murdo Fraser. Alistair Allan.
Can the First Minister indicate what support is available for teachers and other school staff to help manage additional pressures resulting from the pandemic?
First Minister.
We have announced additional funding, £80 million of additional investment for the recruitment of more teachers. That will fund around 1,400 additional teachers and 200 support staff this year, which we hope will bring resilience to the education system, but also help those who are currently teaching in our schools. We're also very mindful of the wellbeing of school staff at this time. The Deputy First Minister earlier this week confirmed an additional package of support developed through the Education Recovery Group, which is focused on staff wellbeing, and that's part of a £1.5 million funding package to help manage additional pressures as a direct result of COVID. So that includes mental health support, new professional learning for post-probationary teachers, and a new coaching and mentoring offer. And that will complement the excellent practice which is already taking place to support the wellbeing of staff and schools across the country.
Murdo Fraser, to be followed by Joe McCarthy.
Thank you, Presiding Officer. The Lord Advocate, who is a member of the First Minister's Government, admitted in court last month that David Whitehouse and Paul Clark, formerly administrators of Rangers Football Club, were the victims of a malicious prosecution by the Crown Office, something unprecedented in recent Scottish legal history. Already they have been paid £600,000 in costs and are claiming another £14 million from damages which will have to be paid by the Scottish taxpayer. Does the First Minister agree with me that this scandal demands a full, detailed and public inquiry on conclusion of the litigation so that those responsible can be held to account?
First Minister.
I would agree. I'm going to be careful here. I may be getting this wrong. I think Murdo Fraser is a lawyer by background, so probably shouldn't require me to remind him of certain things. These are still live matters before the court. In fact, he alluded to that himself. So I will be deliberately very limited in what I say, because it would be completely inappropriate for me to do anything else. Also, it involves issues relating to the independent prosecution functions of the Crown Office, not to functions of the Lord Advocate as part of the government. And I think, again, these are distinctions members of this Parliament, particularly those with a legal background, should probably understand. What I will say, and I'll say it in general terms because of the caveats I've just had to insert there, is, of course, anything like this in the fullness of time when there are no live proceedings underway, it is appropriate there would be full and proper and appropriate inquiry into what gave rise to these circumstances. But I think that is probably as much as I can or should say at this point, which I hope and expect Murdo Fraser will understand.
Joan McAlpine to be followed by David Stewart.
Thank you. Does the First Minister share my concern that the UK Government's blatant power grab masquerading as the Internal Market Bill means critical funding that should be transferred to the Scottish Government will instead be controlled by Boris Johnson and the Tories at Westminster, regardless of the spending priorities of the people of Scotland?
First Minister.
Yes, I do. I have many and varied concerns about the Internal Market Bill. Firstly, it breaches international law, something that the Advocate General for Scotland clearly couldn't stomach and resigned his post. Unfortunately, the Scottish Conservatives seem to just roll over and accept anything that Boris Johnson decides to do. Secondly, it is a power grab on the powers of this Parliament. And yes, it gives the UK government the ability to override or undermine the spending priorities of a democratically elected Scottish government supported by a democratically elected Scottish Parliament. The Internal Market Bill is a full frontal, no holds barred assault on devolution. And for those who might say, well, the leader of the SNP, she would say that, they should listen to the union supporting First Minister of Wales, who has exactly the same opinion of the Internal Market Bill. The only way in future, in my view now, to protect the Scottish Parliament is for it to become a normal independent Parliament, which I think will happen sooner rather than later.
David Stewart, be followed by Bruce Crawford. David Stewart.
Thank you, Presiding Officer. The First Minister will be well aware that thousands of businesses are struggling across Scotland with the economic effects of coronavirus. But Tuesday brought a rare ray of sunshine when the High Court found in favour of the Financial Conduct Authority's test case over business interruption insurance claims, which removes a major roadblock and gives Scottish firms and the thousands of jobs they support a victory of right over might. Does the First Minister agree?
First Minister.
Yes, I do. I think that is a positive judgment and development, and at a time of a multitude of challenges for Scottish businesses, I think the Member is right to see this as a positive thing, which I'm sure businesses will welcome.
Bruce Crawford, to be followed by Rachel Hamilton.
Thank you, Presiding Officer. First Minister, we know unscrupulous and dangerous criminals will always seek to take advantage of people through scams, unbelievably, even during a pandemic. This includes, for example, pretending to be from vital test and protect teams, who are doing such a crucial and fantastic job in keeping us all safe at this time. Would it be possible for the First Minister to explain how people might be able to tell the difference between a genuine test to protect contact tracer and a scammer? And does the First Minister agree with me, these criminals really are despicable?
First Minister.
Yeah, I do think anybody who is attempting to scam, test and protect is despicable, and that's probably the mildest word I can think of to describe them. Unfortunately, we've been reminded in recent days that there are a small number, and it is a small number of people who will seek to exploit any circumstance for their own gain, and it is absolutely disgraceful. Let me be clear, I addressed this the other day, and I think it is really important for people to understand what a legitimate contact tracer who gets in touch with you will do and will not do. So a contact tracer will ask you only for information about your movements and about people that you've been in close proximity to. A legitimate contact tracer will never, ever ask you for your bank details or your computer passwords. They will never try to sell you anything. They will never tell you you have to pay for a test, and will not offer any other services. Legitimate contact tracers from Test and Protect will also always call from the same telephone number, and that telephone number is 0800 030 8012, and they will give you the option of hanging up and calling back on that number so that you can verify that they are legitimate. As with all types of scams, anybody who becomes the victim of an attempted scam should of course contact police, the Police Scotland number 101, and if you need more advice about this, that is available from Advice Direct Scotland, and I would encourage people to listen to this to make sure they know what they can expect if they get a call from Test and Protect, and if you think that somebody is trying to scam you, to hang up the phone, but be confident in Test and Protect and the legitimate contact tracers who round the country right now are doing an excellent job.
Rachel Hamilton, to be followed by Shona Robertson.
Thank you, Presiding Officer. A constituent has raised an issue of disparity in treatments available from NHS and private dental services. She told me that as an NHS patient, she cannot get a filling. However, if she was a private patient sat in the same chair, in the same room, receiving the same treatment, she could. The Chief Dental Officer noted that from August the 17th, all dentists, both NHS and private, are able to provide a limited range of aerosol-generating procedures. However, it seems there is no requirement for NHS dental contractors to provide the same service. First Minister, can you explain why private dental patients can be seen quickly, yet NHS services are not resuming, leaving constituents frustrated and in pain?
First Minister.
Not only can I try to explain it, because it is a legitimate issue, I think I did so last week in response to the exact same question from one of the Member's colleagues, but I'm more than happy to do it again because I understand the concerns that are raised. We have guidance in place, and the Chief Dental Officer has, understandably, and as people would expect, spent a lot of time making sure this guidance is right so that it allows for the safe provision of dental treatment, and that now allows a limited aerosol-generating set of procedures, but there are still restrictions in what can and can't be done. There is also, though, to supplement that, and has been right throughout the pandemic, a network of urgent dental care centres across the country for people who need urgent dental care. We expect, and we've addressed this issue previously, dentists who are not providing NHS care but only providing private care to abide by the same rules and regulations as we expect NHS dentists to do. We have a different relationship, though, with private dentists because of how they're funded, and therefore it is not we don't have the same ability to insist on that, but we would expect them to do it. But our focus, and the focus of the Chief Dental Officer, is to get NHS dental services working fully and properly, as safely and as soon as it is safely to do, and he continues to focus very much on that.
Shona Robertson to be followed by Neil Findlay.
Thank you. Can I ask the First Minister to provide an update on what support measures are being put in place to help Dundee recover and regenerate after the COVID-19 pandemic, and to welcome the confirmation that Social Security Scotland's headquarters will be at the heart of the city's regeneration project in the waterfront, potentially employing up to 900 people?
First Minister.
Well, thanks, Shona Robertson, for the question. We're investing £150 million in the Tay Cities Region deal over the next decade, which will help, we hope, create high-quality jobs and enable a sustained recovery. That programme includes £25 million for the Growing the Tay Cities Biomedical Cluster project at the University of Dundee, £6 million for the Cyber Quarter at Abertay University, and £20 million to invest in skills across the region. As part of our £30 million for regeneration to support construction, as part of the Economic Recovery Stimulus Package, £264,000 of that will go directly to Dundee. And in addition, as Shona Robertson has alluded to, it was announced yesterday that Social Security Scotland will become the first tenants in the waterfront regeneration project. This new public service has the potential to employ up to 900 people in Dundee and contribute, of course, up to £100 million to the wider Scottish economy. So I think it is good news for Dundee and a sign of the ambition all of us have for that city.
Neil Findlay to be followed by Bob Dorris.
Biscuit makers are moving into what they call the shortbread season, where they increase production in the run-up to Christmas and New Year. Yesterday, low-paid key workers at Burton's Biscuit Plant in Sighthill in Edinburgh were on strike over a miserable 14 pence per hour pay offer. This stands in stark contrast to their bosses, who awarded themselves a 33% increase. Will the First Minister join me in calling on the management at Burton's to immediately return to negotiations so that the production of this iconic Scottish product can begin again in time for Christmas and New Year?
First Minister.
I always encourage employers to get round the table and negotiate with workers, I always encourage the proper contribution of trade unions in that. I'm not familiar with all of the details of the situation at Burton, so I won't comment on that directly, but in general, yes, I would agree with that. Obviously, the Scottish Government doesn't have the power to regulate pay negotiations between private employers and workers. Of course, we don't have control over employment legislation. I wish we did in this Parliament so that we could set stricter conditions around all of these things. But I absolutely call on employers at all times, but particularly at times like this, to treat their workers fairly and to include workers and trade unions in all decisions that they are taking, not least in the important issues of pay and conditions.
Bob Dorris, followed by Mark Ruskell.
I'd like to thank each and every person
in my constituency meeting emergency food need for the work that they do. However, I'm sure the First Minister will agree no one should have to rely on food banks in the first place. Can I therefore ask the First Minister for her response to the report from the Trustful Trust, which alarmingly forecasts a 61% increase in food parcels in the coming months?
First Minister.
That deeply concerns me, as I know it will concern everybody. The Scottish Government has invested throughout this pandemic significant amounts of money in helping to tackle food insecurity, and we will continue to take that very seriously. That includes, it's not limited to, but includes the money for school meals to carry on throughout the school holidays. We've also increased the welfare fund and will continue to do everything we can to support organisations involved in providing food to those who need it. Obviously, we're also seeking to address poverty at source, which is why the new Scottish Child Payment will be so important, and work is underway to have applications for that open later this year and payments made early next year. Of course, some of the solutions to this lie in the hands of the UK Government. We need to make sure that we do not have a return to austerity and that we continue to see increases in the investment to tackle poverty, and we badly need to see some of the changes to the welfare system that have exacerbated poverty in Scotland and across the UK changed so that we have a welfare system that lifts people out of poverty, not drives them deeper into it.
Thank you. Mark Ruskell, to be followed by Liam MacArthur.
I don't know if the First Minister has seen David Attenborough's documentary Extinction, but it dramatically laid bare the collapse of the natural world on which we all depend. So can I ask, when will the government pay farmers to recover nature rather than degrading it? When will government stop the dredging of our nature-rich seabeds? And when will government end the destruction of wildlife for driven grouse shooting?
First Minister.
I'll ask the Environment Secretary to write to the member with updates on all of these specific issues, but we take the health of our natural environment very, very seriously. We discussed this week at Cabinet, the Environment Secretary is reminding me, the challenge we have in meeting our climate change ambitions and the work that we are doing to take that forward. And we continue, notwithstanding COVID, to give that great priority. And of course, you know, peatland restoration, forestry planting, all of these things are incredibly important to us as we seek to meet those targets. So the Environment Secretary will give a more detailed update, but I can assure the member that these issues have the utmost priority within the work of the Scottish Government.
Liam MacArthur, to be followed by John Mason.
Thank you, Presiding Officer. The Scottish Childminding Association has described the Scottish Government's offer to childminders as, quote, completely out of step with what's been given to other parts of the sector. In Orkney, 26 childminders have been excluded from the Transitional Support Fund, a picture that is repeated across the country. After I shared the latest response from the Children's Minister, Marie Todd, one local childminder contacted me last week to say that she felt undervalued and defeated. She said the Minister was, quote, deflecting the question by making it about our income when it's about development of our practice. Given the priority the First Minister says she places on expanding childcare, why does our government not appear to value the role played by childminders in delivering this vital service? And will she now agree to give them access to the support they deserve?
First Minister.
Well, I and the government do highly value childminders, and from the outset of the expansion of early years education and childcare, we have made very clear that childminders are a crucial part of that. Through the pandemic, there has been support made available to childminders, rightly so, both the transitional fund and to make sure that we are supporting them longer term. I will look at the correspondence Liam MacArthur refers to, and if there are further issues we need to address, we will of course consider doing that.
John Mason, to be followed by Jamie Green.
Thank you very much. I wonder if the First Minister would agree that with the number of coronavirus cases increasing, it does create a real worry for the economy and jobs, and makes it all the more important that the furlough scheme should be extended by the UK government. Does she feel it would be helpful if all MSPs across the parties were to back this call?
First Minister.
Yes, I do think the furlough scheme has to be extended, and I hope everybody across the chamber will back that call. I know many organisations and interests across the country back that call. I've been encouraged by some of the noises coming from the UK government around this, and the Chancellor in particular, over the last couple of days. So let's hope that we will see something positive. The Scottish Government published analysis yesterday of the impact of the furlough scheme and the impact of withdrawing the furlough scheme. So this really matters. If it is taken away completely with nothing to replace it at the end of October, then we will see a large number of avoidable redundancies. And I don't think anybody, regardless of politics, wants to see that happen at this moment in time. So we've always said we are open to discussions about the nature of any extension, whether it is a blanket extension or a sectoral extension. But one thing we know, and I think all of us have to recognise, and certainly we are reminded of that in the figures right now, this pandemic will not end at the end of October, and therefore the impact on the economy will not end at the end of October. So the support for businesses cannot end then either. And I hope that's a call that will be echoed by people right across this chamber and even outside this chamber.
Jamie Green to be followed by Kenneth Gibson.
Thank you, Presiding Officer. The First Minister spoke earlier about the effect of COVID on young people. And I think whilst they're less likely to suffer from some of the severe physical effects of the pandemic, they are still suffering the mental health secondary issues. Members from right across this chamber have been raising the issue of access to mental health waiting times since I joined this parliament. They were disgracefully long before the pandemic hit us, and they haven't got any better. So can I ask, will the First Minister finally commit to ensuring that any young person who needs access to CAM service will get it within the 18-week period that her government committed to? We cannot let these young people down a day longer.
First Minister.
Yes, we are committed to that. And as I've said many times before, and the member is right, before the pandemic, but also in some of the challenges around this, of course, have been exacerbated because of the pandemic. But delivering on that involves increased investment, which we have delivered, but also involves reform of how we deliver mental health services. Part of the challenge on CAMHS is that there hasn't been enough in the way of preventative early intervention services, so people end up referred into specialist services when, if they had help earlier, wouldn't be required. And that extends waiting times for those services. That's why we are putting more counsellors into schools. It's why we have the commitment to the wellbeing service for young people to give that early intervention and preventative focus. So this work is really important. One of the complications of the pandemic has been the difficulty in having face-to-face consultations, not just for CAMHS, but generally within the health service. Many health boards, including Greater Glasgow and Clyde, for example, have been using that to try to reduce some of the longer waits for CAM services, which is positive. However, we want to see the reform of the service carry on as quickly as possible so that we have that right balance between early intervention and access to specialist services.
Kenneth Gibson to be followed by Donald Cameron.
Thank you, Presiding Officer. First Minister, the Advocate General for Scotland has quit following UK Government plans to breach international law by overriding parts of the Brexit withdrawal agreement. Democrat Speaker of the House of Representatives Nancy Pelosi, backed by presidential candidate Joe Biden, warned there is, and I quote, absolutely no chance of a US-UK trade deal passing Congress if the Good Friday Agreement is undermined. Given the utterly irresponsible behaviour of the UK government barely 3 months before Brexit hits, what impact will this have on Scotland, our economy, and as part of the UK, our standing in the world?
First Minister. Well,
Brexit will have a bad impact on Scotland's economy. Leaving the transition period at the end of this year without a deal will have an even worse impact on the Scottish economy. Even with a deal, given that it would only be the most minimal of deals, will mean that there is, in the midst of a global pandemic, an avoidable impact on our economy. But this UK government seems to be intent on trashing the UK's reputation internationally. To have a bill that threatens peace in Northern Ireland, certainly, and you know my views on this makes it, I think, even more likely that Scotland will become an independent country, but egregiously breaches international law, I think says everything that needs to be said about this UK government. And I think even people on their own side, still with the exception of the Scottish Tories, who seem to have the highest tolerance of all of these dreadful things that the UK government does of anybody. But many people, even on their own side, are seeing how unacceptable all of this is. And many, many eyes in Scotland are being opened to the fact that we'd be much better off in charge of our own destiny rather than being governed by a UK government of this nature in particular.
Charles Cameron.
night saw the third major landslide at the A83 Rest and Be Thankful Pass this year, causing yet more woe for residents and businesses in Argyll and the West Highlands. The Transport Secretary has spoken about holding a consultation in December on a new permanent route, with a final proposal to be announced in March next year. For the sake of the many communities affected, will the First Minister give a cast-iron guarantee that this will happen?
First Minister.
Well, this is a situation that obviously causes inconvenience and distress to people who rely on that transport link. Before the latest landslip, of course, I can't remember if it was last week or the week before, I addressed this at First Minister's questions. There is a commitment to find a long-term fundamental solution to this, and there are now a number of options that are being considered on a cross-party basis, and I think that is right and proper. But the government is absolutely committed to making sure that we have not just temporary stopgap solutions, but that there is a sustainable long-term one found, because I think the residents who rely on this deserve exactly that.
Thank you very much. That concludes First Minister's questions. I've just urged members, as they're leaving, to observe social distancing rules. I'm going to suspend Parliament. We resume at 2:30 with questions to the corporate body. Parliament is suspended.